So, right, so we started off the first week by pointing out that an unavoidable fact of any rabbinic approach to creation of human beings is that there are multiple stories in the Bible and you have to account for them. Right, then we went to a Gemara in Ketubot. The Gemara in Ketubot made the suggestion that initially it's proposed that there was a dispute as to whether there was one or two yitzirot of the human being. Right, yitzirah we're translating as a formation, as distinct from a briah, which is a creation. And in order to explain a dispute as to whether one says one or two brachot that end in yotzer adam, the form of the human being, so the Gemara initially suggests that there was a dispute as to how many formations of the human being there were. And then decides that, no, everybody agrees that there was only one formation of the human being, and the dispute depends on whether or not we care about how God thought about creating human beings or how God actually created human beings. Right, one formation or two. Right, that seems to be the conclusion of the Gemara there, is that the agreement, there's actually complete agreement about the nature of creation. There was only one formation. And complete agreement about what God thought. Everyone agrees that God thought about two formations. Right, the dispute is only whether the bracha follows the thought or the act. Okay, right, that was stage number one. Okay, then we moved on to Gemara and Brachot. The Gemara and Brachot starts from an entirely different standpoint. It begins with an exegetical question, right? When it says, "Vayiven Elokim et Hatzela," that God built the whatever Tzela is of Adam, what was the Tzela? And the two suggestions were a face or a tail?
Face.
Or a tail. Right, a face or a tail. Now, the presumption of the Gemara seems to be that if we assume that the Tzela is a face, right? So that means that the male, the masculine and feminine aspects of the original human being were parallel and equal. Whereas if you assume it's a tail, so then you have an obvious lack of parallelism, right? Because the masculine aspect has a face and the feminine aspect has a tail, right? So those aren't parallel. So you then follow, right? The Gemara Brachot then follows this up with a sequence of challenges to each position. As if you think it's a face, then what do you do with this? If you think it's a tail, what do you do with that? What turns out, right, and we'll see this inside in a moment, what turns out is that if you look at it structurally, it's actually a whole series of challenges to the position that it's a face, followed by one challenge to the position that it's a tail. Okay, what's the challenge to the position that it's a tail? The original verse. And all the challenges to the position that it was a face come from, or are scattered all around the Bible, right? And in all those cases, the Talmud seems to say, well, if you say it's a face, this makes perfect sense, right? But if you say it's a tail, then how do you explain this? And it resorts to all sorts of positions, right, all sorts of explanations as to how it is you could explain all these verses which imply a parallelism, right, between masculine and feminine, right, right, even if you told the position that it's a tail. For example, you have a verse which says, God created me aftan for. So what does that mean? So if you say that God created human beings with two parallel sides, so we understand. But if you say God created human beings, the face and a tail, that doesn't sound like you're creating two equal parts. So we say, oh, that's talking about time. It's not talking about physiology. Right? In the context of that, we said, what does it mean when it said God created them male and female? Right? It also sounds like it's a perfect parallelism. So how do you explain that if it's a tail? And so we resorted again to saying, oh, that doesn't mean the nature of the human being. That relates to that description, God created the male and female, is talking about the imagination of God, but not the real, right? But not the real thing. Right? After we've gone through all those explanations, then the Talmud says, gee, but going back to our original verse, what does it mean for God to build a face? All right, it says the one verse that drives us towards the belief that it's a tail and not a face, for some reason, is the claim that God built the tzela into something. Whereas if we were to presume that actually what you have is an androgyne, so God doesn't build it into anything; God just divides it. Okay, so the solution is right. So the solution ends up that if you say it's a tail, so we understand perfectly well that God had to take a tail and build it into. Right, into a full female human being. But if it's a face, meaning, apparently, that we think of the human being originally as an androgyne, so why do we talk about building it into something. It already is something. Right? So it turns out that the Talmud's perspective is that the position that it's a face works everywhere except in its original context. Right? And the position that it's a tail works nowhere except in its original context. And we have to decide whether we're more interested in interpreting the verse locally or more interested in trying to come up with a consistent pattern throughout Tanakh. We can explain everything either way, but there are advantages. But the advantage of the tail position is local, and the advantage of the face position is global. Okay, right, that's just a sense of how the Talmud's argument is structured. And if you see the editing of the Talmud as literarily conscious, so then you know that a rhetorical trick is being played, right, to distract you from the fact that it's weak in the original verse. So we ask all these questions everywhere else to try and show you how strong the position that it's a face is. And then we say, oh, by the way, what did that verse that you claim you got it from mean? Right, and we saw, oh, yeah, there's something we can make it mean there too. Okay? And if you were structuring it, right, so you have an envelope structure which begins and ends with the exegesis of the verse by even Elokim et Hatzela. Okay. We'll look at that inside in a moment, especially the weaknesses of the tail position, and then we'll see if we have an idea of where the sugya actually ends. But I wanted to begin by addressing probably the central theological question under consideration, which is, why do we care about what God thought? Right? And why would we? Right, why would there be a dispute about whether we care more about what God thought than what he did? So I'm going to start with, I guess, something that Jerry's heard before, but not sure everyone else has.
But you know that.
Right, Jerry always claims that it's useful for me to repeat things to him. I was a high school teacher again. I get this a lot. People telling me that it's useful to repeat things. So when we began, right, so I started by pointing out that this notion of divine imagination does not apply specifically to the question of the creation of male and female, that there's at least this famous case, which is cited in Rashi at the outset, which is about God's thoughts initially about mercy and justice. So what's the significance of God's intent to create the world with justice and then combining it with mercy? So Rav Eliyahu Dessler has since discovered, since I originally found it in him, that actually there are other figures who've come with the same idea, connects this to another famous Talmudic passage. That passage is famous mostly for the end which Moses shows up in Rabbi Akiva's classroom. Before Moses shows up in after he shows up in Rabbi Akiva's classroom, so he comes back to God, and he asks God, well, so what is the reward that Rabbi Akiva will get for this great Torah? And God shows him Rabbi Akiva's flesh being weighed in the marketplace, and Moses, understandably, is somewhat nonplussed by this reward, and turns to God and says, Zu Torah v'zu schara, right, this is Torah, this is his reward, and God replies, silent, that's how it came up before me. So Rabbi Dessler and others say connect the Allah and Allah l'machshava to the Allah l'fanai, and say that there must be a connection between the divine imagination, so to speak, right, that of the Rashi sites and the claim that God, right, that something came up in God's mind about Rabbi Akiva. And it's good that Deborah's here, because she can argue with this, as she always does.
We're talking about a mullet.
No, we're not talking about a mullet. It's a different one. It's the other one that you always argue with. It's the mercy justice one. So Rav Dessler makes the following argument. What kind of response is God making to Moses by saying, you know, be quiet? That's what came up in my mind. So his suggestion is that clearly it must mean, it's a reference that Rabbi Akiva was being judged by justice devoid of mercy. Okay. So now we have to ask the question, why is Rabbi Akiva's reward to be flayed alive because God shows him no mercy? Right? That seems a questionable form of reward. So Rav Dessler argues, and I'm translating him, so at this point I would be cautious. Rav Dessler said something which I will then adapt as follows. Maybe he's responsible for it all, maybe he's not. that he says is that mercy is a divine mercy is a diminution of human dignity. Because the dignity means being responsible for your actions. Justice, right, a world of justice is a world in which all your actions have consequences and are taken with great seriousness. Mercy means that on occasion some of your actions will not have consequences. Right? God says, God reserves the right to say, you know what? Okay, that doesn't matter. Right? You get a mulligan, or right? You get a do-over. What that means is that you can't really know the consequences of your actions, and not everything you do is meaningful. Right? Some of your sins matter, but some of them don't matter. And that's a much less dignified way of existing. And God initially, right, God thought of creating a human being who was capable of being fully responsible, and discovered that the world wouldn't survive if God held us accountable for everything, and so he introduced mercy into creation. But there was a reason that mercy was introduced, what we call b'diavad, after the fact, under the pressure of necessity, as opposed to originally, because really human beings should live in a world of justice because we're supposed to be dignified. So Rabbi Akiva, right, Rabbi Dessler said, is the reward for his Torah is that he gets the chance to try. Nobody else is even allowed to try living in a world of justice. Rabbi Akiva gets a chance to try. He fails. Everybody fails. And he fails, you know, and he discovers what the world would be like for everybody else who lives in the way. You know, he just gets his flesh flayed off with combs in the marketplace, right? Anybody else presumably wouldn't have made it, you know, even for the couple of weeks he made it or whatever. And we would have found even more horrible things to happen to them. Perhaps they'd have been flayed alive with even hotter combs. Maybe that would be worse. I don't know. Maybe at that point you wouldn't feel anything. Okay, so that's as I understand it, of Dessler's assertion.
It's not to spin on what Akiva says when he's flayed and asked, does he say something to the effect?
I love God with all my. It doesn't necessarily interpret that. It'd be fun to try and tie it in, but it doesn't necessarily interpret
so
that.
So the implication of this is that God came up with Plan B before Plan A had a chance to be tried out. So it was purely in God's mind to suddenly realize that Plan B was needed. It wasn't as a result of an experiment that failed or anything like that, which is what we would normally think would be the sequence.
Right. But it, you could say it's the result of a thought experiment.
Yeah, okay.
It wasn't tried out before the flood?
No, because we're talking about this distinction between mercy and justice shows up already before creation. Right? It's the explanation for the divine name problem, why it's Hashem Elokim in the second story and Elokim in the first.
Also, in both of the two.
It's also true. That's good.
In both Cain and Adam and Chava.
That's right. I hadn't actually thought of that. If you say that God tells Adam and Chava that the day you eat from me you'll die, and then they don't, and then he tells Cain...
He tells him that you're going to be wandering, and Cain says, I can't handle that, so he puts a sign on
that's
him
true.
So that the animals won't eat him.
Right. So and he tolerates Cain... Cain puns, right? Cain is told that he's going to be Navanad, and so he does is he builds a city called Nod. And God tolerates Cain's sense of humor, as opposed to declaring him in violation and banned for life. Yes, Deborah.
So is that incorrect idea that Jonah had yells at him, and perhaps Jonah never loses it, but isn't the point of that not how we're supposed to think about mercy? Or would Rav Dessler say that only on planet Earth is one not supposed to think about mercy that way, as far as our world is the way it is?
I'm not sure what you mean by supposed to think about mercy that way.
Isn't that the only tachanun that God is screaming at him about?
Jonah
accuses him. Yeah. Of being Erech, of being Kel Rachum V'chan and Erech HaFayim V'Rav Chesed.
Right.
And God
So far as I know, God admits it.
Yeah.
Right.
So God seems to believe that mercy is a good thing there, not a...
Mercy is
necessary. Not an unfortunate
No, if God, if it says it's fortunate or unfortunate, it's necessary. It's not a notion of... in rabbinic tradition, right, Yonah is the boy who was resurrected by Elijah. And why is that? Because Yonah is Yonah ben Amitai, right? Yonah is the son of truth. Right? Elijah represents truth, and what Elijah represents is this attempt to introduce strict justice into the world, right? That's what he is in Tanakh. Elijah is the one who wants to make every action have consequences. You're evil, it's not gonna rain. Mm-hmm. Right? You know, the biblical reward and punishment, right, which is purely hypothetical in the real world, in Elijah's time becomes real. Right? The heavens get clouded over and everybody knows exactly what the consequences of sin are. So I think it ties in perfectly. I think it's one of the amazing rabbinic readings that Jonah is the boy Elijah resurrects, and that's because Elijah stands for truth. Okay.
So the truth is that we need mercy, is that it?
The truth is that we need mercy. But here I want to move to the segue into what I want to suggest for the background for here. The truth is that we need mercy, but should aspire to justice. Rabbi Akiva's life, tells us that we need mercy, but we shouldn't, but it's not something to celebrate. We live in a world which is imperfect and therefore needs mercy. But the goal, an impossible goal, is to reach a world of justice. Whether that is an infinitely receding horizon, or an attainable horizon, is a different question. I know Stephen Schwarzschild argued this about the Messiah, the Messiah should be an infinitely receding horizon, but always had to be visible. And I've argued that the structure of Genesis as a whole is the structure of the Torah as a whole is that way, where it starts in one impossible place and ends, and the reason the Torah has to end before we actually get to Israel is we'll discover that Israel isn't Eden. Right? So in the Torah, the perfect place is supposed to be an infinitely receding horizon. I don't necessarily buy it with Schwarzschild, but I take it in Torah.
Wait, so justice is an infinitely receding horizon?
Yeah, a world of justice, right? You can create a world which is more just, but actually a world of pure justice would not be attainable in this world. The Kabbalistic school of Rabbi Chaim Vital has a similar notion about redemption equaling justice, because what they suggest is that the famous statement is that we rule like that. These and those are the words of the living God, right? But the halacha follows Beit Hillel. So what is it? Right. So how do we reconcile that? So we have all sorts of pluralistic suggestions, but the Tzfat Kabbalists came up with an idea. They said, what really is going on? Since Beit Shammai are usually the stringent and Beit Hillel are usually the lenient, so they took that as meaning that Beit Shammai represent the law as it would be if we lived in a world of justice, and Beit Hillel represent the law as it is in a world of mercy. And they therefore suggested that in the Messianic era, we would actually live in a world of justice and the law would follow Beit Hillel, and that's
Beit
how
Shammai.
We learn. Beit Shammai, the law would follow Beit Shammai, and that's how we can, and that's how we can account for both of them being the words of God, because there's the merciful and just aspects of God, and Beit Shammai represent the just, and the world is striving towards redemption, which is the capacity to live in a world of justice. Okay, so if one takes that as a paradigm, we can then argue that the purpose of divine imagination is to create an aspiration in this world. The world as it is. So the world as it is simply as it is, and the world, but the fact that God thought of it differently, means that the world has a toward, and not just an is. And what I wanted to suggest philosophically is that it's actually necessary, if you want to conceive of a world which has a point, So that means that God has to be capable of imagining a world which is different than what there is, If God creates an imperfect world with the hope of, for the sake of achieving redemption, so that itself involves an active imagination, So I think it actually fits together very nicely, That we would suggest that any time we talk about God imagining, what it means is that God, That God creates the imperfect. With a goal of the perfect. And if we take that, we might be able to understand the creation of gender the same way, and say that there must be something, whatever the model is, we say that God thought of two formations, ended up creating one, or God thought of creating two and ended up creating one. There has to be something ideal, but ideal but non-implementable in this world, about the thought. as opposed to the is, but the goal is to achieve as much as possible of the ought in the is.
Is it possible also to say that the that it's not an issue of that the perfect can't be made,
yeah,
but that the perfect, in fact, is not perfect in the sense that it's dead, stillborn? I mean, that in fact, the tension between the imperfect and the perfect is what is desired after all. That in fact, if a world just was created, it would be stillborn. It would be impossible. And the reason you go to the second thought is not... You're assuming a reason why there's a second thought, right? And that's a critical point.
So, okay, well, the question that you're... If I can translate your question, right? The way I would translate your question is that there's an inherent logical problem with the notion of redemption, right? Because you can either say either God needs the process or God needs the result, right? Right? But if God needs the process, he should want the process infinitely. If he needs the result, he shouldn't bother with the process. Right, the notion that God needs a process leading to a result, right, is deeply problematic. Right, why if God would be happy with a perfect world, let him create one.
Well, it's the journey, not the end.
Yeah,
that's another way of saying it. I mean, it's a duality, right? I mean, you could say that the journey is the point.
Yeah, so by saying so that's, you know, that's where you get the attractiveness of this notion of an infinitely receding horizon.
Well,
right? That God
certainly
wants a world that's just permanently a journey towards an actual redemption, but never actually gets there.
Certainly it's in harmony with Maimonides' idea that the world, that the sacrifices were created as sort of a
crutch
for the people.
Well, okay, so two different things we need to talk about here.
Yeah.
Well, hold on a second. Right? One is, I would say that clearly the traditional concept of redemption was not one of the infinitely receding horizon. It was redemption. There is a, with the exception of something else we were talking about in Maimonides, right? Not that point, I'll get back to your point, is that Maimonides, if one reads the Laws of Kings carefully, does not actually ever talk about an end of history. There's implicit in Maimonides' position that there will not, that as opposed to, not Maimonides argues that in the world of redemption, the evil inclination is externalized again, and so that it is theoretically possible for the world to be perfect forever. In Maimonides' redemption, human beings are still human beings, and I don't think he was actually naive enough to believe that a political system could be created, right, that would be self-sustaining forever and immune to any human sin.
I was just reading in
yeah.
He suggests actually that Maimonides, he said that it would be a permanent state and that that would be the final implementation.
He thinks that Maimonides thought that if the Mishnah Torah were ever implemented, it would last forever.
Yeah.
You know, he can't prove it one way or the other. Maimonides is not noted for modesty in that sense, that one could say that. But at the same time, you know, Maimonides had read Aristotle, and so, you know, he knew which types of governments governmental structures decayed to which types of governmental structures. So it's hard for me to believe that he would have thought, if people can sin, right? I guess in principle, if there's a capacity for sin, it's not clear to me how any government could be permanently immune to the consequences of its leader sinning.
Right? Since the official low opinion of all other people, and other people are going to have to be in charge, since he'll be dead. But I want to ask, does this cyclical redemption-destruction cycle work as well as an ever-receding redemption that never gets there? Does that also solve the theological problem?
Yeah. Yeah, I think you know that because the world could always go towards, you can have an infinitely receding perfect, right? Perfect, you know, a machine that would go of itself. You never actually get to, right? Each redemption can be perceived of, you know, as a shadow of an ultimate redemption, but never actually gets there, right? Because the ultimate perpetual motion machine, right? A political perpetual motion machine isn't actually possible. I haven't read Sharon Newland's book yet. I should read it, but I.
He said he met
uh-huh. Okay. I would go with May.
Right.
But the other reading of Maimonides, it seems to me, is the only warrant for any vision like that, you know, traditionally, right? He's the only one who really talks about the notion of a redemption which is never couched as an end of history. So that's the question.
Anyone.
Would he ever believe in that or not? I don't know. If he believed in a static time, then basically there isn't anybody who didn't. Right? that would be... there's a problem with short straw. Now, the issue, the notion of progress, right, which is what you're talking about, religious progress. Mm-hmm. So that's a, so maybe, you know, that, so we, you know, that would require a full discussion of what progress is. I tend to be torn on the one hand between, you know, saying that the core Jewish value is a belief in progress, mm-hmm. and taking Shaw's prefaces very seriously, in which he, particularly, I think it's in Back to Methuselah, but maybe it's in Man and Superman, where he talks about how, you know, the way progress works is we focus on one thing, and we make progress in that, but it takes all our energy. So meanwhile, all sorts of things we're not noticing are getting worse and worse and worse, and the next person will make progress on those things that we don't deteriorate. And actually, right, actually, you know, all history is cyclical in terms of moral progress. My belief system accords better with the first, but my intuition fits better with Shaw. So I have difficulties with that notion of progress. I certainly don't buy into any notion of inevitable progress or linear progress. So now that particular notion of addressing that particular notion of whether Maimonides believed in progress in terms of animal sacrifice, right, and that issue. So I would say briefly, and perhaps we'll do this as a full unit somewhere else, and it really interests people, the essays for this are online. What I prefer to read Maimonides in the guide in light of various rabbinic statements which say that the surrender of animal sacrifice, it's not that it responds to a historical need, it responds to an innate psychological need, and there are sacrifices, quote unquote, right, to be made by giving up animal sacrifice.
There's a cost.
Yeah, there's a cost. And rabbinic, right, the rabbis, I think it's famous, so the rabbis say that they sought to extirpate the evil inclination for adultery from the world and discovered the next day that no chickens had laid eggs. That's a fairly famous metaphor. What people
they also tried to ban music, and the markets.
The market brought that back.
Yeah.
People couldn't survive.
Oh.
But in the same story as they try to extirpate the evil inclination for adultery, they actually do extirpate the evil inclination for idolatry. Mm-hmm. The question is, does that have a cost? And the answer is, it does have a cost. The cost it has is literally that the magical fire, or the spiritual fire, leaves the temple. And what they're telling you is that the evil inclination for idolatry and animal, right, and the religious passion of idolatry, the religious passion in the temple, are the same thing. And when you give up the meaning of animal sacrifice, right, the gain is that you lose the impulse for idolatry. The loss is that you lose you lose all the passion of the temple. Right, I can develop that. I have developed an essay much further about the notion of the transcendence through the physical. If one actually understands idolatry is about the sanctification of the physical. And that actually is in almost any ultimate theological scheme, right? God creates the world to be sanctified. Mm-hmm. So I think you can read Maimonides that way, that he sees animal sacrifice as responding to a human need, not a historical need. Mm-hmm. And there's progress, but progress comes at a price, and perhaps the ultimate world will be one where you can do both. Perhaps not. There's another place which I'm not, right? In the guide, Maimonides sort of says, right, that, you know, we tell people this nowadays, right? Everyone makes fun of animal sacrifice nowadays, but everyone at the same time makes fun of meditation, right? Makes fun of meditation, right? Just like, you know, we got rid of animal sacrifice and got people into speech, and eventually we'll get people out of speech and into meditation. That sounds more like a progressive thought. But first of all, I think it's not a great reading of Chumash, and secondly, I just tend to be very suspicious of progressive perspectives. I think I'm not a great believer in progress. That would be my shorthand. Okay, let's go back to the text.
How this is you're applying this ideal and the real to.
I haven't repeated. What I just said is that now we have a model, right? Where the question we're dealing with: why do we care what God thought? And the answer is now that, right, we have a model in which we say that what God thought is always going to be an ideal, it's not an ideal which doesn't have any reverberations in our world, right? It ends up being the point towards which the actual aspires. Okay, right, and then we have to figure out, right, what is it about gender that God would have wanted, which he couldn't do, but which nonetheless we aspire towards. Okay, so if in the text we were in, which was Brachot 6.
That's what I wanted to ask. Yeah. I mean, I thought maybe you were suggesting that thinking of two kinds of
so now I have to figure out. Well, so I have to figure out what it is, right? Now all I have now is a structure into which I can place the data. I still don't know exactly what it is that God thought, right? I don't know, right? And I don't know what it is that God ended up doing, because I still have two creation stories. I need to account for them somehow, right? That's our basic problem. Is I have two creation stories and I have to account for them. And worse, I have a claim that in reality everyone agrees human beings are only formed once, right, when it seems that the story we have is that they were formed twice. Right, I have to figure out how we interpret the biblical, how we get the biblical verses to match the ending. So
both Gemaras have to agree that everybody agrees with one creation?
No.
Okay, so you don't have to say
that. Right, we could also claim that there are multiple rabbinic voices and that the text in Ketubot uses this imagination entirely differently. Right, I pointed out last time that it could be that one text sees the imagination as there being two creations, and the other one sees the imagination as there being two createds. Right? And we don't know which one of them ends up being dominant. Okay, so I want to
just to clarify, yeah, sure. When you say two creations, you don't just mean that the two stories in Genesis are creation.
No, it means that human beings were formed twice.
Two acts of creation.
Yeah, two acts of creation.
One of which Eve is separately created, specifically separately created.
Presumably, if we're saying an imaginary two acts of creation, well, you have two choices. You can claim that that's just describing the second story of creation, right? And the whole second story of creation is not real; it's just what God thought about, and really they were created together. Mm-hmm. Or you can claim that initially human beings that the thought was for human beings to have two independent formations, and the end is that Chava is created out of Adam.
Out of what?
Out of Adam. Right, those to me seem the two possible imaginings. Right, right. One is that saying that there were supposed to be two formations means that they were right, that the thought was Genesis 2. And the other is that the thought was something which exists in neither Genesis 1 or Genesis 2. The thought was of independent male and female separately created directly by God from raw materials, and in the end one is created out of the other.
Because that's never explicit.
No. Okay, so where we were on the bottom of Brachot 61a, okay, so let's, right, so again, we're in the middle of a series of challenges against the position that it's a tail. Right, that the tzela out of which Chava was created was a tail. Sure.
Stop here with a question.
Sure.
Not knowing Hebrew, I have wonderful freedom to sort of think anything based on the English, and I wondered whether the word that you translated as countenance,
yes,
and the word that you translated as a tail,
yeah,
might instead be interpreted as meaning countenance, meaning a forethought, and tail meaning afterthought.
I mean, literally, no.
Okay.
Literally, it means a face and a tail. I have to figure out. If you want to treat it metaphorically, we could talk about it. But literally, yeah, a partsuf is a face, and a nav is a tail. I mean, they're anatomical descriptions.
So there's no particular way of saying that what we're talking about here is the nature of this intention, where that's what they're arguing about.
The
countenance in the sense that it looks forward, basically,
yeah,
and tail, you know, is the thing after.
I think that the debate is not about literal history, the debate, right? So these have to stand for something. I'm not sure I understand the specific metaphor you're using. I think that face and tail have to be metaphor in some sense. That I can see.
Yeah.
I don't think the Hebrew will make a difference one way or the
okay.
other on that. Okay, so on the bottom of it we say, right, so the first challenge we had was about the verse in Psalms, Achor Vakedem Sartani, where you created me aft and before, and the response was, right, that's not talking about parallelism, it's talking about human beings as being situated, the formation of human beings being situated between the sin and the destruction of the flood. The temporal situation. The second one was dealing with the redundant yud in the word for formation, and we said that means that that human beings were created with sort of pulls both ways between between their former God and the evil inclination that God planted within them. Okay, so the third challenge is we understand how, according to the person who said it was the face, we understand how, right, what the biblical verse means when it says, male and female, he created them. Okay, right, because that seems to create a perfect parallelism between male and female. But if you say it's a tail, it's not true that God created them male and female. God created one being, right, out of which eventually a female was created. So, right, so how do you explain this? So we say is that according to the person who created tail, we need to respond the way Rabbi Avohu did, because Rabbi Avohu had a contradiction between the statement male and female he created them, and for in the image of God he made the human being. And Rabbi Avohu responded by saying that the first one, male and female he created them, was what God thought, but in the end, in the image of God he made the human being. Okay, right, so ultimately, right, the fantasy emerges from the verse, male and female he created them. Okay, now if we treat this text as parallel to the text in Ketubot, so we're saying is that this is the, or even if we read it here, right, so the claim, but if we treat it in parallels, the claim is that there were supposed to be two independent formations of human beings, right, if we put the two together. So if we say that Chava was created out of the tail, what we're saying is that initially God thought about creating the human beings, right, a male and female human being independently, two separate formations of two separate createds. Remember, we talked about there was an ambiguity. Is it two separate formations or two createds? And the solution is that the original plan was that there were supposed to be male and female human beings, or a male and a female human being, created independently in the exact same way. And in the end, God instead creates the world the way it is, right, in which Adam is formed, and then Chava is built and not formed.
But the creation of two could be the androgen also.
Creation of two could be.
That's how the other Mandamar holds.
Yes. So, right, so we end up with a dispute, right? We have, right, in this reading, right, in this reading, the person who says it's a face doesn't need imagination. Okay, the person who said, right, the human beings were created with two faces, right, male and female. There's no imagination. That's how God created the world. And as for the contradiction between Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, the solution is that God divided. Right, Genesis 1 is talking about, right, it says that the creation of the Adam in Genesis 2 is actually an androgyne. And the creation of Chava in Genesis 2 is simply the splitting of that. Right? So if you say that the Tzela is a face.
Genesis 1 is androgyne. 2 is a splitting again.
Genesis 1 is, and the Adam created, right, the Adam created in Genesis 2 is an androgyne. Right? It's the same, right? There's no, right, the first thing that God creates is an androgyne. And then, right, the creation of woman is a division, not a building. Okay, right? And there's no active imagination necessary. The second position, which says the tail, right, is that, right, is really, there's no androgyne mentioned at all. Right? The position is that God thought about creating males and females entirely independently.
Yeah, it could be that he imagined an androgyne. Because that's how the other person interprets that verse.
Yes.
So it could be an androgyne.
It could be, except that the language is, right, is... if you're looking to both, it's Shtei Yitzirot. So if I read those two...
Right, they may not be consistent, the two
verses. Right, but if I'm reading the two texts together, which is what I'm trying to do now, is a synthetic reading. Right, with a synthetic reading, you end up, right, with two completely different readings of gender. Right, in one version, human beings are created androgynes and then split, and everything happens exactly the way God, right? Exactly the way God thought of it, and there's no imagination of it being different. Right? We just know what God did, right? And God created the world original androgyne that splits. In the second version, if my synthetic reading is correct, God imagines creating men and women entirely independently and separately, and decides instead to create one out of the other. Okay, so
another bit of the ointment. Ashi understands the other Gemara as the fantasy is the androgen. Rashi has it the other way. He has the one is the androgen, and
right.
the two is as it would require a later creation.
I have to go through it again because the Tosfot have the whole.
Right, but he does it the other way.
Right, Tosfot goes the other way around. Yeah. Right. So I'm sticking with one reading now.
Okay.
So now we have to right. So now the question is to try. One thing we should point out is that in this reading, it turns out once again, as it does in the initial Rashi, that Genesis 1, is the fantasy, and Genesis 2 is the reality. So it turns out in this reading, that actually the rabbinic reading is consistent, right? So Genesis 1 is consistently the fantasy, and Genesis 2 is consistently the reality.
When you say this reading, you mean your synthesis of these two?
Yeah.
Okay.
So now we have to try and think about what is it that is accomplished, by doing it this way, and what is the aspiration? So before we do that, we should just finish the text. So we go on to the second half of the story of Brachot. So then we have a very technical question, Scripture says he closed flesh when God took the tzela. It says he closed flesh either in its place or underneath it, and for some reason we think underneath doesn't work so well if it's a tail, because I guess you'd have to put stuff on top and on the, right and underneath. I'm not sure exactly why this is such a challenge. We say that no, right? What it means is not underneath it. What it means is where it was. So you have to close right. When it says that God put flesh underneath it, it doesn't mean that he put flesh underneath it. In order to form the woman, he put flesh underneath it because Adam now had a cut. So the answer, because Adam now had a cut.
Oh,
right. So he closed the cut. Maybe that's what it means. Okay, so then we get to We're on the last page of the back. Okay, so then we get to the only challenge, which we have the position which says a face. So according to the one who said tail, we understand why Scripture writes that he built the tzela into any shop. But according to the one who said countenance, what is the meaning of anti-built? Right? There's no construction going on. Right?
Well, doesn't she need a body?
So it could be that she needed a body. But if you assume it's a complete androgyn, then there's no issue. It's just a split.
It has two heads and four legs and so on.
Exactly. Okay, that seems to be the premise of the challenge.
Is something that's left over.
This is why they're arguing.
It could be they just think that building, is too elaborate a description for just adding in a few organs. We would call that repairing, not building. Maybe.
Okay.
So we say that the reason is to teach the interpretation of Rav Shimon ben Manasseh. Because Rav Shimon ben Manasseh taught and interpreted, right? What does it mean when Scripture writes and God built the tzela, right? So we say vayiven means not that he braided, not that he built, but that he braided. Okay, right? So it means that God built Chava's hair up, right? So that Chava herself, was completely done, but was necessary was to make Chava attractive. So this is in the interpretation. Right, we're now in a universe in which men and women are created equal, autonomous, identical, and they're just split. So what does God have to do? What God has to do is he has to create, he has to create attraction between the two. So the problem apparently is that attraction is not obvious. between the male and female in this interpretation, and it has to be stimulated artificially. Which I think actually there's clearly some kind of very powerful claim about the nature of eroticism built in there, right? That men and women are not naturally attracted to each other. God has to intervene, right? To create attraction. Right?
Even when they're naked and very lonely.
Well, this is what most women
could be, or it could be, you know, the rabbis, you know, as Jerome did, you know, at some point say, you know, if you were being rational, this doesn't make any sense. Right? You know, you're being attracted to, you know, to various combinations, random combinations of atoms, some of which you'd find disgusting if you simply, you know, move the inside outside. Right? So obviously there has to be some divine intervention to make attraction possible.
Works the same way in reverse, mister.
Yeah.
I just thought I'd mention it.
you need better translators.
Well, it seems to privilege heterosexuality.
Yes.
Oh, well, the whole narrative.
Yeah, I don't think you...
Homage does sort of...
Yeah, I don't think you can read the story without privileging heterosexuality.
But it's saying that when they
were
just...
Well, cross-dressing would work here, too. Yeah. I mean, this isn't, you know...
Well, but she's got this body, you know...
Difference is the point.
Okay, then we quote another interpretation which may or may not be designed to solve with the same problem, which is that Rav Chisda taught that God built Eve's body like a storage silo. And Deborah, you were going to explain this because I always got it wrong.
Say it again?
What it means for women to be built like storage silos.
Wide on the bottom and narrow on top.
Yeah,
right.
You were good at that. I never got it.
I think that's the shape you build the silo to store grain in. Sort of like an upside-down funnel.
Right.
It promotes airflow and doesn't let the animals in too easily. I don't remember the details, but that's the shape you build silos in. I mean, they're not as narrow at the top as they used to be. But.
Okay. It seems to me that in some way we're making a claim is that, right, that what has to happen is...
Did you say wide on the top and narrow at the bottom?
Narrow at the top, wide on the bottom.
Oh.
It seems to be that what has to happen is some claim that what is not yet possible after the split is reproduction, right? And the right, and so God intervenes to make reproduction possible.
But even
study geometry or not triangles. So why is that relevant?
So women are not in fact wide on the bottom and they are on top.
Right, so I had to try to figure out what that, you know, again, so I thought you had an explanation of what that really meant.
I know what it meant in terms of the silo. I don't know what it means in terms of the body.
I thought you did.
It's really about narrow waist, wide hips.
Yeah, narrow waist, wide hips, right.
I thought that's what you said, yeah.
It's a pretty narrow part of your body.
Well, it's not the face, right, so that can be built afterwards.
Hmm. Maybe it means women have narrower shoulders than men generally.
And without that, we certainly couldn't reproduce.
Comparative.
Maybe. Okay, and then we conclude the immediate passage by...
See, these guys aren't completely blind. You think in this height that they wouldn't be looking around. They can
pause. Oh, come on. No, we have blessings to make. We have blessings for men to make when accidentally seeing beautiful women.
Accidentally.
Accidentally? What about when they see them on purpose?
So we just meant to provide an occasion for the blessing.
Try and do it, you know, together with a fruit tree in spring, so you can get all your blessings in together.
And a thunderstorm.
And a thunderstorm with lightning.
You might have to run into shelter and comfort the poor woman in the dark.
She's a Talmud Chacham.
All right.
Yes. Excellent.
Okay. And then we, interestingly enough, decide to throw in one other interpretation of a verse. It could be that it's just here because. In the collection from which this was taken, it was the next line, or it could be that it's actually supposed to close a unit, right? Which says, right, and God brought her to the Adam, right? So Yerubin Elazar says that it teaches us that God was a shoshvin. Not entirely clear what a shoshvin is, but it might be that go-between works, right? That God served as the matchmaker, the agent, right? The agent in matrimony, right. Etc. Okay. So what I want to suggest here, as a right, as the beginning, is let's try to figure out what are we what are we trying to account for in the, right, what are all the rabbinic readings trying to accomplish? What they're trying to accomplish, it seems to me, is that on the one hand, you have a text of Genesis 1, which seems to see men and women as indistinguishable. And you have to account for that, right? That you have a biblical text which really cares about gender, right? As we've pointed out, right, it uses all those terms for gender throughout, and yet, right, in several of the creation stories, this text which cares about gender, right, and if both, and we can demonstrate that both from the use of multiple terms for gender in the creation stories, and the fact that even in this creation story, in which gender seems to be irrelevant, human beings are the only gendered beings. Right, so gender matters, and it's a very peculiar thing for gender to matter, and yet to be right. The whole statement that we make about this thing that matters is that it doesn't matter. Right, is that right? There's no distinction between male and female anywhere in the story. So you start off with a text that seems to be, you know, wholeheartedly egalitarian, and then you have another text, Genesis 2, which doesn't say that at all, right? Which has women as derivative, all right? Only one formation of the atom, right? You have to find some way of reconciling those two texts. Now there have been a number of efforts to do this, which is probably the most famous is Rabbi Soloveitchik's Lonely Man of Faith, which does a very powerful job of trying to figure this out. Although in the end, to my mind, he doesn't actually succeed in explaining gender. Right, he explains, right, what he explains is why you need two as opposed to one, but he never actually talks about why men and women. But it seems to me that that basically the text here is offering two alternatives. One alternative is to say, yeah, you know what? Really, we accept the egalitarian principle, and so, right, the way we solve it is that men and women are we get rid of the story about derivation, and we simply say that it's a story about a split. The weakness of that interpretation is that it doesn't actually, right, it doesn't account for, right, there are irreducible unevennesses in the story, right? God brings, right, if it was a split, then God should not bring Chava to Adam, he should bring them to each other, right? And so ultimately that breaks down in the last line, which is why I think this poses the unit, right? The problem with the interpretation of two countenances is that God brings Chava to Adam as opposed to bringing them to each other. So there has to be something, right, in the story which accounts for a differentiation of male and female, right? And that differentiation has to center on the notion that Adam is fixed and Chava is brought to the Adam. Okay, so there is a reading which is fully egalitarian, but that reading founders, right, in the text of Genesis 2.
Are all the animals brought to Adam for naming?
Animals are brought for naming.
And now she is brought for naming also, isn't she?
Well, not clear.
And he names her.
The animals are not actually, the animals are brought for naming, and then they're also brought, you know, but there's a subtext, which is they're brought for mating.
For mating,
and he doesn't find a mate.
For him to.
Right.
And he names.
Right.
But is this a kind of incident? Now here comes now the next.
Well, it says explicitly that he brought them all to, and you know, Adam names them all, but he doesn't find his razor. So now God says, okay, but it's not good for him to be alone. Let me make him one.
And when he wakes up, he says, this one is right.
Yes, exactly.
And he names her.
Yes.
Suggesting that there's a possibility that the egalitarianism is a fantasy. Have an egalitarian fantasy followed by a...
So in the first reading, we have an egalitarian reality, which is deeply problematic in the text. In the second reading, what we have is the way in which we account for the egalitarianism of the first creation story is by claiming that it's a divine thought, right? Which for some reason can't actually be implemented in this world.
What she's saying is that the fantasy is. Imagines something, what God imagines is to.
Yes.
Is that what you're saying? And
yeah.
And that for some reason.
But we've been saying that the things that God imagines, while they're not possible, are supposed to be what we're to strive for.
Absolutely.
Which is curious.
All right. So that's what my first level reading right, of the story has to be that we have to end up saying that, actually we have two very different readings. One is that human, that really we created an androgynous human being which was then split, right, and we don't know exactly what the split is, but whatever the split is, it remains an entirely equal split.
Why can't you have a lesser half of an equal?
Because all the proofs, at least in this reading, now you could textually if you wanted, but all the proofs that they cite are proofs about parallelism. Right, if they're designed, right, fore and aft, right, male and female are all in the same text, no difference between them. Right, so that reading, as the Talmud sets it up, it seems to me, is a pure egalitarian reading. But it's a purely egalitarian reading which involves the split of a unified being. Whereas the alternative reading the Talmud offers is that the image is of two independent beings. The notion of a merged being, right? The notion of a merged being never right? There never was a merged being. There never was an androgyne. Right? There was a thought of two independent beings, and actuality, right, of a being and a derivative being. Right? And so somehow one has to say that the original thought of two independent beings was not sustainable. But the aspiration of the world that's actually created, right, is to try and get to a world, right, is try and get to a world like that. Now, Aviva Zornberg points out, I think, not incorrectly, that you can find a very, basically identical vision in the rabbinic metaphors of the sun, of the sun and the moon. Probably all of you know, right, the rabbinic idea that originally the sun and the moon were the same size. And then the moon complained that no one could tell who was really in charge, right? And so God said, "Okay, I'll make you smaller." Now it doesn't take anything to realize that the sun is a masculine image and the moon is a feminine image. What Aviva Zornberg talks about, right, I think very powerfully, and perhaps we'll read that next time. In her book, is the notion, right, that one doesn't have to see this as a compelled diminution, but one sees, right, the notion of making space for the other, right, is actually a powerful act. We can talk about that next time. But certainly you have a recurrent theme. Nechem Yipolin has published about this in Hasidic literature. You have explicit images of a time, right, of the ultimate redemption is the period when the moon is as big as the sun again. Right, that's a recurring image in Kabbalistic thought. That the diminution of the moon, right, is a compromise necessary for existence in the world. When you can't have two kings sharing equally, but the aspiration of the world is to get the moon back to the original size. That would be a model for saying that we live in a non-egalitarian world with aspirations of egalitarianism. Of egalitarianism, used today in a purely non-halachic sense.
Stretching it a bit, but the second law of entropy basically is that everything will become equal,
right,
and that's the death of the world. So I mean, one view is that in fact that death of the world, right? That everything being equal, and it comes back to the thought that the initial thought that he had was sterile. That in fact it's by making differences that you create all this.
Sure. And in Kabbalistic thought, the world is made possible by difference, which is a miracle, because the definition of God is that he is simple. Right? So the whole existence of difference, right, is both a diminution, because it means that God isn't as present, right? But what makes progress possible, because God can't progress. Yes.
Plus, the obvious leading is out of that women are. But you could also say, it's not said about any of the animals, but Adam, that there's something missing in him, for God then has to create him. Or if you were giving this German, you would have a problem.
Okay.
Yeah. The masculine would have to shrink.
Aren't they both masculine in a way?
In rabbinic thought,
feminine, but Yireh is masculine.
In rabbinic thought, the moon is a feminine image because of right? Because of faith, because of menstrual phases. Menstrual phases. Okay, I want to make one more point, then we should finish this week, and we'll do next week is finish this text and perhaps move into other, all right, other texts that deal with how gender was initially constructed, rabbinically. What I wind up saying, though, is right, you know, and this is right on your point, is that if you take, right, if you take the rabbinic text at its right, its face value, nothing changes about the nature of men and women. It doesn't say anything about that. Right. What it says is, right, what it says is, what changes is whether the creations are independent, right, or whether the right, well, there's one creation, one formation, followed by a derivative formation. The end product isn't any different, right? And so the question you then have is, to what degree does process, right, carry consequences other than, right, other than ontology, right? Because it doesn't say anything about, right. What it says is that the world is created in such a way, right, that Chava is derived from Adam. Now that may have social consequences, it may have emotional consequences. It doesn't say anything, it doesn't break the definition of Nekeva is no different. Right? It could have been created entirely independently. And it offers the possibility of readings in which, right, and this again I would follow Aviva Zornberg, in which the whatever differences there are between men and women are the product of, right, of choices, right, or of circumstances, as opposed to ontology. Right. But the sin of eating the fruit.
I mean,
well,
God says you're going to be sexually.
Yes, and no.
It doesn't have to relate to any other part of your life.
Well, even that.
Okay, so what I want to do next time is actually finish this text and then move on to texts about the sin, and see there also. Right, again, it seems to me that, for the giving a command, right, if you do this, then you will die, right? So anytime God can make if-then statements, right, so that's already imagination, right? Otherwise, it should be when statements, right? But if you can translate what God's saying as an if-then statement, it's saying, well, right now it's this way, but if you were just, right, if that were to happen, then that would happen, but if that were to happen, then that were to happen, right? So here again, you have a notion of divine imagination, and if, as at least some people do, you read the story of Eden not as a historical story, but you can read it, but you can back read it, right? It's Eden as a hypothetical original state to which we aspire to return. So then we have imagination being used in the same way, right? As a vision of a world which is not, right, which is not, and that would tie in with my reading of the whole Torah. Right, again, which is framed between Eden and Israel as two impossible places, right? But the whole structure is that you have to live in this world, but the world, right, but the world that you live in always has to be bracketed by, right, by impossible worlds which one aspires towards, right? Whether you look back or you look forward, right? Because if you look back to a world in which it was only God, right? You look forward to an end of history. So that's where I want to pick up next time, which I'm not sure yet will be next week or in 2 weeks. So I will send out an email, but I know we don't have school Wednesday. I'm not sure. We may have an influx, so I will try and send out an email very shortly.
Although they might be interested in coming. You never
see.
Any problems here? You are around?